describe a narcissist?
The word narcissism, it describes an experience that is horrific. It is described as a complete lack of empathy. But actually, what they do is weaponize empathy. Oh, I'm just the worst person in the world. No, you're not. So you start rescuing me rather than holding me accountable.
Very manipulative.
Insanely manipulative.
That leads me into the most common red flags.
The biggest red flag is going to be love bombing. When you're being love bombed, you get serotonin, oxytocin, dopamine, and your body becomes addicted to it. We are talking about a physiological response that is equitable to heroin addiction.
Seriously?
Yeah. Then we go on to the gaslighting. Gaslighting isn't, I disagree with you. Gaslighting is, I wasn't there, I'm disagreeing with you, but you're also crazy. There is something wrong with your mental function. There's plenty of research that shows long-term exposure to gaslighting will lead to suicide. If someone compared you to your partner and said you were just like them, would you see it as an insult or a compliment?
Welcome back to the show. Today's guest is someone whose voice so many people need to hear. Helen Villars is a psychotherapist, coach and author who specialises in narcissism, emotional abuse, neurodivergence and recovery. She is a co-author of the Sunday Times bestseller, You're Not the Problem, The Impact of Narcissism and Emotional Abuse. Helen hosts the popular podcast, The Liberation Effect. On social media, Helen has over 500,000 followers across all of her platforms, to include Instagram, TikTok and Facebook. She's appeared on BBC Radio 4's Woman's Hour and has been featured as an expert in The Independent, The Telegraph, The Mirror, The Express, The Irish Times, Hello Magazine and various radio shows. In our conversation today, we'll dive deep into what narcissism really looks like, how people get trapped and how you rebuild, not just heal, but reclaim your identity. Helen, it's an honour to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So how are you?
Yeah, great. Thanks. Yeah, busy and it's all going very well. Thanks.
That's really good. So I'm so glad that you could come down today. Well, I have found, even in my role as a family law solicitor, that so many people are talking about narcissism.
Yeah.
And of course, you being the expert that you are and all over social media, have you found that you have had so many DMs and comments about this subject?
Yeah, I mean, it's so common now. People are really identifying with it, with the abuse that surrounds it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's the danger that too many people are using the word narcissism, but it describes an experience that is horrific, quite honestly. So, absolutely.
So let's jump straight in.
Sure.
Why narcissism? What drew you to this particular topic?
It's a really interesting question. I was seeing in my clients, and this is from when I was training, so I was in placements and things, and I was seeing this kind of repeated pattern, particularly in women, of this fear of saying no, rejection, kind of people-pleasing behaviour, and looking back into childhood and seeing that maybe mum or dad, usually mum in this situation, would be quite domineering emotionally, demanding emotionally. There was a lot of shame or fear or control being used in childhood. And there was one client in particular who was describing a situation with her mother and said to me, you know, this, that and the other. And I said, it sounds quite narcissistic. And she was like, yeah, it does. And then she went off and researched it and I went off and researched it, came back and we were both kind of like, okay, wow. And it went from there. And it was just that I was seeing it so often in my client group that it really pulled me in. I've always been interested in psychology anyway, but it was just seeing it so much, the effect of it rather, not necessarily the actual narcissism, but the effects of the abuse.
And then once you really started to get into it and study it almost as a speciality, what was the most surprising thing to you about narcissism?
Ooh, that's a great question. Well, so I did a master's working therapeutically with adult children of narcissistic parents. And when I was doing that, one of the questions that I get asked the most often is, do they know they're doing it? And while I was doing the research, I kind of found the answer to that question. And it was pretty devastating and awful, because the answer is largely yes.
Really?
Yeah.
That's quite sad, isn't it?
Yeah, it's awful.
Yeah. Mm. So you have a huge following on social media. Right. What do you think that tells us about people who are potentially living with or have been the child of a narcissist?
That it's more common than we think. You know, people can be very dismissive about, you know, what I said earlier about it being a bit of a buzzword and that everyone's a narcissist these days. And it's, I think this has happened. And it was so normalized in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s,
That's
80s.
Crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, and it's just devastating because the ripple impact is massive as well. It's not just that one person that's affected. It goes out all the way.
Now, you mentioned there that it is a buzzword. Mm. And I said earlier on that I'm finding a lot of my clients are describing their exes as narcissists. Yeah. But from a professional point of view, how would you describe a narcissist?
Well, if we are going off clinical description, there are 9 traits. Or maybe it's 13 and you have to... No, I think it's 9 and you have to hit 5. But there are 5 main ones that we would look for in the kind of description of the victim.
Yeah.
Those would be grandiosity or superiority, being better than absolutely everybody, knowing everything, you know, their way is the best way. And if you challenge it, whoa, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
Entitlement, which would be, well, I want it, so I'll have it at the cost to other people.
Yeah.
Exploitation then with that. The exploitation being, well, I want the thing, you can get me the thing. I deserve the thing because I'm better than everybody else. So I will use you to get what I want, because I'm entitled to it, right? So you've got grandiosity, entitlement, exploitation. Then we've got empathy. And there's a bit of a difficulty for me at this point in time, actually, because I've been doing some more research around empathy and narcissism. We often, or it is described as a complete lack of empathy. And that is true to a point, but actually what they do is weaponize empathy. Now, in the past, I'd have called it motivational empathy, but my correction is that it's actually compassionate empathy, which is what it would be described as psychologically. Okay. But everybody gets caught on the word compassionate because we hear compassionate and we think, oh, that must mean it's nice. No, no, this is still the same thing. So it's still this motivational thing. Like, I can use your empathy to make you do things for me or to get you to leave me alone. So I'm just the worst person in the world and I can't believe you don't deserve me.
Yes.
Makes you go, no, no, you're not, you're not. So you start rescuing me rather than holding me accountable, right?
Yes.
And then after
very
that...
Very manipulative.
Oh, insanely manipulative, because it's there's the consciousness. Mm. I know that if I do this thing, you will stop focusing on the thing I've done wrong and start thinking about my feelings and making me feel better, because you'll see that I'm wounded, right? And most people, because... they are empathetic and compassionate, will step in and try and reassure.
Yeah.
Whereas actually the best thing is to say, that's not what I'm saying. The point is this, right? But we can come on to that later.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we've got self-awareness of the impaired self-awareness. So there's not a complete lack of self-awareness. It's impaired. There's enough to know if I do X and Y, I will get Z. But there's not enough to, it's maybe not even care about the impact. It's there's an awareness that there's an impact, but meh. It's your problem, not mine, right? So those 5 main traits are what we're talking about when we're talking about narcissistic personality disorder in a clinical sense.
Yeah.
Narcissistic traits, however, can exist, but they might not be then across the threshold of diagnosis, but they're still really toxic and harmful and difficult to be around. It's just that there's more hope for them to change or heal those traits.
You know? So would you describe it as a personality type, a disorder, or a spectrum?
Do you know, that's such a great question. Can I answer yes to all 3?
Okay. It's that complex.
Yeah, it is. It's very complex. It's a cluster B personality disorder, MPD, right? Which means that the personality type is then this very grandiose, entitled, exploitative, manipulative personality. There's research that shows that it's there's an intention to cause significant harm to significant others. It's about control. It's about all of these different things. And the thing being that there is a personality type in the disorder, right?
I see.
And then the disorder is its spectrum itself.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So you could have someone who's very, very overtly narcissistic, And if you think of certain politicians, maybe you could see that there.
Oh,
and I'm not
going
to name names because, you know, don't want to get sued. Although, okay, I could come to you maybe. But you also have a covert presentation too.
Yeah.
And somebody could have overt and covert traits and still be diagnostic. But yeah, it's so all three is
all
the
three
answer.
Apply.
Yeah.
What's the line between somebody who is self-absorbed or dangerous to your mental health?
I would say cost to others. Like if my kind of self-absorption is about my ambition, my drive, my need to kind of get ahead.
Yeah.
That doesn't hurt other people. Like I'm not trampling or exploiting or using and discarding other people to get where I'm going, then it's not actually harmful, is it? But if my self-absorption is at the cost of your well-being, then we're talking about, you know, that place of being harmful, I would say.
And that leads me into the most common red flags
that
people may excuse. Let's start with those that people sort of think, oh,
great,
that's in the early days, you know.
Yeah. Love bombing is a term that is thrown around as well. And I think people get very confused by that too. One of the biggest disadvantages we've got as a society is we're taught not to be rude, right?
Yes.
That you, if someone is creepy to you, you don't go, oh, go away. It's like, ha, 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 especially as women, ha, 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 run away, you know, whatever. Yeah. So we ignore our instinct. But your instinct, whenever I track back with a client who's been in one of these relationships, when we go back to the very beginning in the first meetings, there are always signs that they ignored. And it's usually they were just a bit full on. They didn't like let up contact in between. They were constantly kind of bombarding with messages, calls, or it was all just a bit much and overwhelming at the beginning, but it was just like really sweet. So I thought I didn't really think much of it, right?
Yeah.
And if someone is telling you that you are the most amazing person they've ever met in their entire life and they've known you for 3 days, how do they know? What are they basing that knowledge on? Because if that knowledge is not foundational, then they are doing it to make you feel a way, right? And so, yeah, the biggest red flag is going to be love bombing and then mirroring. So you like a Nirvana? I love Nirvana too. Oh, my God.
Oh, okay.
That's amazing, you know, right? There's this kind of alignment of you're being reflected back to yourself, all the things that you love.
Yeah.
And actually, as time goes on then, it's not as it's not kept up, it's not sustained. And the thing with the love bombing, it usually lasts about 3 months. It's unsustainable. And that then is followed by this like intermittent contact, which creates what we call the trauma bond. But when that intermittent contact starts, if you start feeling like things have changed and that, no, I'm just busy, I'm busy, trust that things have changed. They have. Just because they're busy, it doesn't mean things need to have changed this much, right? So the red flags people ignore are the love bombing because it feels nice, you know?
Yeah.
It feels really good.
Yeah, it hits
someone's
that
like,
dopamine.
Oh my God, you're the best.
Yeah.
And like, who doesn't love that, you know? Like, so, yeah, it's the noticing of what's real, what's got foundation. Because healthy people will find love bombing creepy and overwhelming and too much. Too intense.
Yeah.
Be like, no.
Back off a bit. Right. Let's slow it all down.
Yeah. But if you've had neglect in childhood of any kind that has a wound of being not being seen, love bombing is going to hook you intensely because it'll be like all your Christmases came at once, someone finally appreciates you and you're wanted. And what inner child doesn't want to hear that?
Who doesn't want that?
Mm.
Let me go back. You mentioned something there, trauma bonding.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
Wow. The trauma bond is created when somebody uses intermittent reinforcement to basically trigger hormonal responses. So when you're being love bombed, you get serotonin, oxytocin, dopamine. Oxytocin is the bonding hormone. Dopamine, most people will know, is the reward hormone. So you get tons of those and your body becomes addicted to it. And then when the intermittent contact, the breadcrumbing starts, you get the withdrawal from those things, first of all, and then you get cortisol, adrenaline, all those things, because it becomes fear-based. So you go from like hot to cold, and our brains become completely addicted to that dopamine and the oxytocin, right? We are talking about a physiological response that is equitable to heroin addiction.
Seriously? Yeah.
So when people are saying to you, I just can't leave, I don't know what's wrong with me, it's because of that.
Yeah.
And it's horrendous. It's a really horrific thing to try and break, because the person who's causing your pain is the one that can heal your pain. And that is a horrific position to be in, isn't it?
Absolutely. Mm. And when you explain it like that, it fully then, you can fully understand why people stay in these abusive relationships. 100%. On the outside, in a healthy relationship, it's probably too easy to look in and go, well, you could have just left them.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
And people do it, don't they? They victim blame horribly. Like, well, you should just leave. Now, to a point, you're right. There is a place where you are an adult, you've got agency, especially if there are children involved.
Yeah.
Yes, you are the victim of abuse, but you are the one who can provide protection.
Yeah.
I understand sometimes it's safer to stay as well, and all those caveats that people put around it. But ultimately, if children are being harmed because of your decision to stay, that's difficult.
Yeah, that's
very difficult. But yes, it is easier to understand why people do return, because there's this literal physical pull. It's not just a weakness or a you know, mental instability. There's a physiological drive to get something. So the great news, though, is that you can replace that with other things.
Yes.
Right? Find it elsewhere.
Yeah.
You know?
The way you've explained it, the traits of obviously a narcissist, it appears very calculated, very, very seductive. Mm. Do you believe that they know what they're doing?
Yeah. So as I was saying earlier, well, let me put it this way. If I ask you not to do something because it hurts me and you continue to do it, are you doing it with intent or not?
Or with intent.
Yeah.
But going back to the love bombing, is that done with intent?
Yeah.
Do they know then that this, the impact that it has on the brain, the scientific, as you just explained, do they know that that will then be the result?
I wouldn't know that I wouldn't want to assume that they know the science and the physiological side of things, but I would say they absolutely know. If I don't leave space for them to think, then they're not going to reflect that this is too much.
Yeah. All so they're not going to necessarily know all the science behind it like you do, but of course they'll know that, well, if I do this, I'm going to get this result.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think then, well, I suppose we know the answer to this, they will always go for the empath.
The empath. Oh. Empath. So I'm going to trigger your entire audience and say there's no such thing as an empath.
Really?
Right. And then everyone goes, what about highly sensitive people? Still, same story.
Yeah.
Empaths are people who are hypervigilant, who've had trauma. They've had to be really aware and alert to their environment and other people's emotions and other people's states of being in order to keep themselves safe. Mm-hmm. Who was so dangerous in your childhood that you had to predict how they were thinking, feeling, behaving in order to keep yourself safe? So you become highly attuned to your environment, other people's behavior, the way they breathe, the way they walk, the way they shut a door, and you project potentially a feeling onto them. And this is the difficulty with empath, is that there is an assumption that somebody is feeling, thinking, behaving, motivated in a certain way, when that is all assumption. That's not true.
Yeah.
It's also incredibly intrusive and actually a little bit arrogant to assume that you know better than the individual that what they think, feel, are doing, right? But what it also is an unboundaried emotional connection to other people. And when somebody is hypervigilant, what they are more likely to do because of that trauma in childhood is oppress and suppress their needs and put other people first, right? So they put themselves lower and they pedestal people, or maybe not even pedestal, but they might prioritize others over themselves, right?
That people
pleasing kind of behavior.
Yeah.
Which in itself is a tricky one, but maybe we haven't got time to go there. But the thing that happens is that because there's this wound of having to protect self, that then when they're seen, and I'm inverted commas, by somebody going, oh my God, you're amazing, they're very vulnerable.
Mm.
Because actually, but if
they've never had that.
No, they've not. They haven't had it. And then their attachment wound, their trauma, their vulnerability is their empathy for others.
Yeah.
Right. And so they're targets, because the other misconception around narcissists is that they target one specific type of person. They don't. It's a fishing net, a scattergun approach, in that everybody is a viable target. It's just who resists and who gets pulled in. And unfortunately, those people who've got those wounds are the ones that are going to get pulled in.
They're going to get pulled in. Mm. For those that are listening and are thinking, am I with somebody who's like that?
Mm-hmm.
How do you tell the difference between confidence and control?
Well, confident people don't need to control, do they?
Okay.
People only control out of fear. And fear could look like I'm the best person in the whole world. But actually, you can see the ego is really fragile, because people only need you to think that they're the best in the world if they have a really fragile ego.
Yes.
Right? And so the confident person is self-assured, quiet, peaceful, calm. Arrogance and ego is loud, brash, braggy, and domineering. And so that's where the difference lies. Me sitting here talking about this is based on years and years of research, experience, all the different things, right? And if a narcissist was sitting here, it would be based on nothing. Well, I've read a Wikipedia page. I know what I need to know, right? There's a difference between I'm confident, but I'm also able to hear I'm wrong.
Yes.
I'm also to be able to be corrected, hence me talking about motivational / compassionate empathy, because I'm learning about that now, and that I was wrong about motivational empathy as a term. And it's the first time I've talked about it publicly, and I'm not bothered. My ego doesn't suffer as a result of it. I can hear that I'm wrong. The narcissist, how dare you? Who do you think you are? I can't believe you would say all that. You'd think you know everything. And they would try and devalue you. Not the argument, you, the person, right? Confidence doesn't need to be loud. Confidence is usually very quiet.
Very quiet. Good point. Mm. So what does a typical cycle look like?
Ooh. Of the abuse? And So, and this is the same for all relationships, whether it's parent, whether it's partner, friend, colleague. I'm never going to include children in this. And there's a really good reason why, but I'll explain if you would like me to later.
Yeah, sure. The only reason I ask is that in my day-to-day role as a solicitor, people will then separate and then say to me, I didn't realise they were a narcissist until after the separation.
Yeah.
So for people that are potentially still with a narcissist and maybe blaming themselves, that cycle, what does that look like?
Well, first of all, if you're in a relationship where you're always at fault, that's not logically right.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So someone is constantly saying, you're the problem, you're the problem, you're the problem, and never going, I got that wrong, I shouldn't have done that, I'm sorry. Not, I got that wrong, but it was because I was really stressed and I was having a busy day.
Yes.
Right? No justification. Yeah, I got it wrong, sorry, hold my hands up, won't do it again.
Yeah.
Right?
We've all been there.
Absolutely. Haven't we? And that's just it, because it's the human experience.
100%.
We make mistakes.
Absolutely.
It's how you manage that after, right?
And how remorseful you are.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. And not to the point where you're flagellating yourself with guilt, but just that you recognise there is a negative impact and that you want to correct that if you care about that person, right? So, yeah. So, first of all, if you're always wrong, then something else is wrong, because that cannot be.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, so we have the love bombing, then the breadcrumbing. Then we go on to the gaslighting phase. And gaslighting is like an umbrella term. So we've got devaluing, deflection, minimising, denial, dismissal. What do you mean I was there? No, I wasn't. I absolutely. That photo proves nothing. You could have AI generated that. That's nothing. You didn't. No, I just wasn't there. So gaslighting isn't, I disagree with you. Gaslighting is, I wasn't there. I'm disagreeing with you, but you're also crazy. There is something wrong with your mental function, right? So it's not just you're wrong. Mm-hmm. It's you're wrong and crazy, and I'm going to make you doubt everything you think and believe and feel so that you never question me again. So we go to gaslighting phase, and then we might go into, it also includes stonewalling, and that's using silent treatment as a way to manipulate and control, guilt tripping and things like that too. And then we go into the discard phase. And the discard phase is where, you know, they've cut you off, they've dumped you, they're moving on with someone, and they're whatever it might be, they're just not talking to you. And this can be very difficult, especially for children of narcissistic parents, on the grounds that how does a parent just drop their child like that? You know, with no effort, no inclination to heal anything at all. And then the discard phase is also, it's also where we are more likely to start healing, start going, oh, hang on a minute. Well, because we've got this space, right, that we didn't get in the love bombing bit. We've suddenly got this space being like, I didn't like it when they say that to me. I don't like it that they disagree with every opinion, or they make me do everything their way, and their way is the right way. And if I challenge anything, immediately I'm the worst human that ever existed. Suddenly we're starting to kind of see things in a different light. And then just as we're starting to make a change, they've got this weird sixth sense hoovering, where they start testing the waters to see if they can get you back in for what we call supply. The idea that you feed their ego in some way, whether it's as a love adoration thing or a placeholder for anger, because they do that too. And then we go back to the beginning again, back to love bombing, if you get sucked back in.
And psychologically, what is the effect of this constant approval, punishment on on the person who's living with the narcissist? How does that impact them long term?
Erosion, complete erosion of identity. So your sense of self is obliterated. You have no idea who you are, what you think, what you believe, what you like, what you dislike. You have no idea if your reaction is appropriate, inappropriate, over the top. Somebody who's grown up in that environment will be terrified of rejection, of making mistakes. There'll be perfectionism, but it looks different in different people. It's not just that everything lines up kind of beautifully way of perfectionism. It's the, I'm not even going to try, because if I don't do it perfectly, then I don't, right? I can't cope with that. And when somebody is exposed long-term to gaslighting, what we see, and there are studies that show, chronic depression and anxiety, and even will lead to suicide.
Really?
Yeah. Like, there's plenty of research that shows long-term exposure to gaslighting, it will lead to suicide.
Goodness me, that's just...
It's horrific. I don't think people give enough weight to how damaging this experience is. Like, awful.
So when they eventually get to the end of the line and they decide to leave the narcissist, what's that emotional fallout likely to look like?
Oof. Well, you've got withdrawal from the trauma bond. So that feeling of...
Oh, of course. Yeah, yes.
So you're going to have a lot of that going on. Very, very emotionally unstable, because you'll be up and down, relief, grief, relief, grief, relief, grief, you know, cycling around and around. Both are perfectly normal, and you can feel two at the same time. And it's also true that you can miss the person that you thought they were, not the person they actually were.
Oh, that's right? So interesting.
And you can miss the person they promised they would be, who they had the potential to be.
They could have been.
You know, one of the tactics narcissists use a lot in relationship, romantic relationship, and actually in work relationships, is future faking of, yeah, well, we just do this and get this and do that, and then I'll marry you.
Oh, I see.
Or then we'll do this, or then that will happen. Or I just need to get through this, and then I'll stop being incommunicado over stuff, right? So the fallout is going to be quite an emotionally void, and weirdly numb landscape at the same time. So you'll be in this barren land where you don't know what's up and what's down. You don't know what to trust and not to trust. Things will start coming to light that you'll be going, how did I even not see that at the time? And then you will possibly be feeling a lot of shame around that. And what I would offer in that.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, yeah, because there's that self-blame. Like, why didn't I see it? Why have I put up with this for so long? I can't believe I let them do this to the children, or I didn't protect the kids, or whatever. And the answer to that is, you didn't know what you didn't know. And you cannot hold that you responsible and accountable with this you's knowledge, right?
Yes.
And it's on their shoulders that you stand here now.
Yeah.
So actually, let's show them gratitude because they survived, so you could sit there and recover and thrive, right? So it's a place of kind of being compassionate to our younger self, accountability, but also trying to build resilience and identity at the same time. You know, it's a really
That's
difficult
so interesting.
Thing.
Yeah. And how is the narcissist likely to react?
Oh.
You've made the decision to leave. So you as the spouse, let's say, in this example of the narcissist, have all that to contend with. But you've also, I'm imagining, have got some additional issues.
Right.
Because they're not going to take that lying down.
They do not take it lying down at all. So in an ideal world, you would use something called the Grey Rock method in order for them to dump you, because it is a lot easier to manage things.
It's their decision.
Their decision, yeah, right? And the Grey Rock method is basically that you just become as boring as a rock. So you're not mean or unkind. It's just like, oh, do you want to go for dinner tonight? No, I'm okay, thanks. You go, but I don't, you know, so-and-so's having a party at theirs. Should we go? Oh, I tell you what, you go, but I'll just stay in. Or, yeah, not been up to much. No, I haven't got a lot going on. So you're just not providing the supply of information, the companionship. You're not buying into the relationship in the same way. You're not also saying, you're doing this, you're doing that, you've done that. There is no point. There's no point saying to them, this is your responsibility, because they're not going to take it, and all you're going to do is make them angry. And that is the last thing that you want, because they will burn everything rather than let you walk away with the thing.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. You can always tell who the toxic person is, because the toxic person in a relationship, the toxic person will try and burn everything to the ground and destroy absolutely everything for the sake of it. Whereas
rather than take accountability.
Yeah. Or just to even let the other person have their fair half. You know, it's I will destroy it rather than let you walk away with it. Right. And even if that means I get nothing.
Yes.
You get nothing too.
Yeah.
Right.
So what's the first steps then in recovery?
My biggest indicator, or my mantra, my everything that I do roots back down to one core principle in recovery, and that is build your identity. Know who you are. If you know who you are, you immediately, your value system, your belief system starts building. If you know, for example, you are somebody who likes direct communication, when people are not being direct in their communication, as in, hey, you did a thing that upset me, can we have a chat about it? Because I'd like that not to happen again, rather than, well, say what you like, right?
Mm.
You know, you should know what you did. That,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
That indirect, passive-aggressive communication is going to scream much more loudly at you, which means that it's going to cross your boundary.
Mm-hmm.
Your preference is that people communicate directly. Your boundary is that people communicate directly. Your boundary to uphold is whether you stay in relationship with a person who does not communicate directly.
Yeah.
Right? So if you know that that is your value, your belief, that when someone then crosses it, you're going to notice it and you won't tolerate it. Okay. And then if you know that you've got a belief system, a value system, you know then that you've got boundaries, you know then you won't tolerate when those boundaries are crossed, which means in turn that you can trust yourself, because it is not about trusting other people. It's about trusting yourself to recognize it when you see it and do something about it when you see it too. That you will walk away from relationships that are showing these red flags, because you know that even though it's going to hurt now, it's going to hurt a lot more if you stay in it much longer.
Yeah.
Right?
And how do you do that? Because we've just explored the individual who has been love bombed by the narcissist, mm-hmm. who has this constant approval and then punishment, etc. Mm. So you're left in pieces. Mm-hmm. How do you then start to build your identity? That must be so difficult.
It is difficult, and it's also really easy.
Oh, okay.
Because it's proactive is the point, right? So it's things like, you asked me when we came in, would I like a drink?
Yes.
Right? And I said, oh, just some water would be great.
Yeah.
My preference is water.
Yeah.
I know that I would rather have water than, I don't know, a fizzy drink. Or
yes.
I'd love Diet Coke, but I'm not going to have it because it makes me burp. So I don't want to be in this interview burping away, right? So I'm not going to ask you for a Diet Coke,
yeah.
right? If you then said to me, would you like a coffee? And I said, no, I'm fine, thank you. And you bought me one anyway, why would you be doing that? Right?
Yeah.
So I'm noticing that you've ignored my request, my preference, my statement. So that would then go, oh, that's an interesting little behavior. What's that about? Right? So I would just log it. But what we do is we start small. One of the first things that I did for my own identity building was noticing hand washing. Like, well, I prefer the water to be lukewarm when I'm washing my hands, not freezing cold. And I would have chosen potentially freezing cold if, for example, I was worried about how long I was taking for the water to heat up.
Yes.
Right? And yep. that would then get called out or pointed out yep. or what it mocked yep. or what have you.
Yeah.
Oh my God, you make everyone wait. That sort of
yep.
comment. Whereas actually I'm going to notice that I prefer warm water when I wash my hands, and I like using liquid soap rather than a bar of soap. These tiny little noticings are all parts of your identity, and you just build it. You just start, like, walk through the day. Notice, what do you like? Do you like the picture that you see on the wall? Do you like the clothes somebody's wearing? Do you like the perfume? Do you like that smell? Do you like the air, you know, the rain or the sun? What's your preference? You just notice these tiny bits
yeah.
and start building. And then there are exercises you can find online. Mm-hmm. I have these things called value cards that you can just Google, what are some values? And you just organize them into, these are really important, these are important but not as important, these are irrelevant. But the other really big thing with that is shoulds and wants, shoulds and ours. So I should be more patient. I should be more compassionate. Says who? Who's telling you that? Who benefits from you thinking about yourself that way? Why should you be more active? Why shouldn't you rest and yeah. sit on the sofa? You know, why should you always be the one that does the washing up, right? Notice where you're, I'm shoulding, and then why? Who told me that? And then you start, have to undo all the tellings and then rebuild all the actual use instead, you know.
That I can imagine would be very difficult, because it's almost, given that you are the people pleaser,
mm-hmm.
not you, Helen, yeah, I'm just talking about the person that's with the narcissist, that, I imagine, would feel a very selfish position to take.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Okay, so even then, selfish for putting yourself first, who benefited from you thinking about yourself that way?
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
If you grew up with a parent who demanded you prioritise their demand, their need, if you were doing your homework and it was come and unload the dishwasher or come and do X, Y, Z or babysit the children while I go out, no, I don't care that you're going out. Oh my God, why can't you just help? Don't you understand how much pressure I'm under? So you've got a nice little guilt trip thrown into. That's that compassionate, motivational empathy,
yeah.
right? If you've had that sort of narrative, then whenever you meet yourself first, you're going to think you are selfish because somebody taught you that.
Yeah.
Right. But actually, would you begrudge it of somebody else? There's another really easy way of, like, giving it a proportion.
Mm.
If someone else did it, would it be OK? If it is, then why is it not OK for you? Why are you so different?
Mm.
What is so special about you that you're not allowed the same as what you would offer someone else? Why do you have different rules?
Right? And that ties really nicely into just finding yourself.
Yeah.
Having that inner confidence.
Mm.
You know, I experienced lots of perfectionist.
Yeah.
That wasn't good enough.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't look right.
Right.
That doesn't fit right. You know, there has to be this image all the time
yeah.
of being, you know, perfect. And very difficult then sometimes to dress down or to be a bit slovenly or, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Because of the fear of, you know, what will people say? What will people think?
Okay.
And that cycle, I imagine, for many is hard to break as well.
Can I pull it apart with you a little bit?
Yeah, go on.
By all means, stop me and we can take whatever out.
Like, okay.
Obviously, you're in complete control. Okay, so you go out dressed in trackies and a hoodie.
Yeah.
And you're at McDonald's or something.
Yeah.
And someone sees you. What was that feeling there? What happened there?
Complete and utter fear.
Of what? What would you be fearful of?
What they would be thinking, how they would judge me.
Okay.
What they would see.
Right.
That the whole, that me has been shown in a completely different light. That the image is now smashed.
Okay. What image?
The image of perfection.
Okay.
And now they just won't like me.
Uh-huh. So they won't like you because you're dressed in trackies and a hoodie in McDonald's. And the fear is what they would think. And so what are the things that they're going to think?
That I'm not the perfectionist that they thought I was.
Okay.
That I'm not perhaps as knowledgeable as they thought I was.
Okay. So they can't trust you?
They can't trust me.
Can't trust you. You've destroyed some image that they've had of you in their mind.
Absolutely.
And how does that impact you?
Well, it makes me want to correct it. It makes me want to please. I just feel very insecure with that knowledge that they now think that of me.
Okay.
And now I'm sort of panicking. I want to get out of McDonald's.
Okay. Okay.
In that example.
Okay. So if who would have said to you, what do you look like? Who would have said to you, what do you look like? What will people think?
Mm.
And how did it benefit them?
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
You don't have to obviously share.
Yeah.
The other question is, why do they get to decide your worth and your value and who you are?
And I know the answer to that. It was because it made them look good.
Right. So
it was almost, I was the trophy.
You were their image holder.
Yes.
Okay. So if I said to you, that person likely didn't know you at all, how does that feel?
Awful.
Okay. Because?
I suppose because of the relationship.
Right.
You would think, why did they not? Why did they not take the time to know me at all?
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
But if they knew you, would they think that you were a slovenly person?
No.
Right. So why is one time of being...
Yeah.
Right, the defining factor of you?
Yes.
Also, why does a stranger in McDonald's get to decide whether or not you're a good, trustworthy person based on the fact that you're wearing hoodies and right? Why do they get to decide that?
It's so true. You?
But what you're doing there is giving somebody all the power to decide what your value and worth is, right?
Yeah.
And again, the question comes back to who benefits from me thinking about myself that way, right? Because nobody in the whole world knows every internal thought and process and belief that you have.
Yeah.
I know I'm a good person. I also know there are people out there who say that I'm awful.
Yeah.
That's because of their lens, their colouring, their belief systems, and maybe the way I've held them accountable or shown them up, how I've challenged
good point,
them,
actually.
Right? The fact that I'm even sitting here, I know, bothers a few people in my life, I'm going to say. I'm just trying to be careful. Just on the basis that my being here highlights their inability to be here.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
It's nothing that I'm doing. It's their own insecurity. Right? But I just show it to them by existing.
Mm-hmm.
That's not about me. Right? And if someone is going to decide on the basis of me wearing trackies and a hoodie to McDonald's on a Sunday afternoon that I am a terrible, slovenly, awful human being that can't be trusted and isn't good at her job. Okay. That's not about me. Because I know I am, and I know I'm not any of the things that they're saying. That is entirely about them and their need for me to be those things. Why? Because, again, that is not about me.
It's so empowering when you break it down like that. I think what I struggle with is the actual doing it.
Yeah.
You know, it, it is the actual believing in that and not in the moment going back to the, you know, fight or flight, sheer panic. Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. Do you know what I mean? And rather not going out. You know, if there's a day where you just couldn't be bothered to fix yourself up, then I'll just stay in. It's fine. It's easier. Okay. Do you know what I mean?
Do you know what the answer to that is?
Go on.
You have to do it. you don't cure triggers by not...
By avoiding the triggers.
You have to feel and face them and move through them to tell your brain, actually, it's okay, right? We're allowed to wear trackies.
Yeah.
Right? We're allowed to leave without all our makeup done.
That's the scary bit, isn't it?
Yeah.
Fighting through the triggers. That brings me nicely on to my next question. Mm. What and how then can therapy, community, how can that assist rather than you having to do it? There'll be people out there listening thinking, I've got to do this on my own and I can't do it. Mm. How does therapy and maybe community doesn't help? I don't know. Maybe it's only therapy. How does it help?
Oh, I would say community is 100% really helpful. I've got a membership community and this is survivors of this kind of abuse. And they are, the way they help each other and validate each other and support and hold each other accountable. So it's not all... Because often people go, oh, therapists, they're all just saying, like,
you want to hear.
Yeah. Absolutely not. I said this to a client last week after I'd kind of dragged her over the coals a bit. And I laughed at the end and I said, you know, well done, because I know I've pushed you quite hard, challenged you quite hard. And, you know, if you're angry with me at the moment, that's totally valid. And she laughed and went, I'm not. And I said, but if you are, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's not going to ruin our relationship.
Yeah.
You're allowed to be angry with me. Those feelings are welcome. Because I had challenged so hard on some tricky behaviour, some unhealthy behaviour. And this is just it. So there's this community that are validating you, holding you accountable, but without shame. So it's not like, oh, how could you, you terrible human? It's like, that's a bit difficult. Just explain to me what your thinking was around that. Okay, can you see how that might impact that person? Yeah, okay. So what could you do differently next time? So there's no shaming of it.
Okay.
It's just an acceptance that you didn't know that thing, or there was a defense mechanism in place. You're not to blame for having those. That is because of the environment that you grew up in or have been existing in.
Yeah.
So we don't blame you for having a defense mechanism, but we ask you to work on it, right? So therapy is brilliant if you get the right therapist. Mm-hmm. The danger is you don't. That if you get a therapist who doesn't understand this and the nitty-gritty and the really like... how what looks like a really lovely thing, the bunch of flowers on your birthday, is meant to be this gorgeous gift. And well, yeah, but they're just trying to be nice. No, they're not. That was a threat. And sometimes we've got to see that things aren't what they look like from the outside, right? So if you get a therapist who is not educated in the very covert, insidious nature of the abuse, they could end up doing more damage than... good.
Interesting.
Yeah, so you must make sure that whoever you go to really, really understands it and has training and not just like, yeah, no, I've done some reading. No, no, they really know what they're talking about. And check their social. I mean, that's the great thing about socials, right? Because you can see if someone knows.
Yeah.
Right? And really, really check, because the worst, I get so many clients coming who've gone to CBT and have been kind of gaslit about CBT, their feelings and that they're creating them. Now, it's not entirely untrue, but it's not helpful.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
That we react to cues in our environment because that thing holds, you know, if I had a camera thrown at my head, a camera is going to make me nervous, right?
Yeah.
But that camera is not going to be thrown at my head. So there's no need for me to be nervous of that camera.
Yes.
So we rewire the brain in that way, but it's understanding why I'd be scared of it in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the key.
Yeah.
Which not every, what you're saying is that not every therapist has that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you need to just be really sure. And so actually doing like a kind of multifaceted approach of community, like there's loads of Facebook groups and you can get, you know, courses online and things, educate yourself as much as you can around the behavior, the abuse cycle, the different types of abuse.
Yeah.
And then look at different communities and therapists. With the communities, just be mindful of echo chamber kind of behavior. Look for...
Explain that.
Oh, just in the idea of, when you've got a hammer, when you've only got a hammer, everything's a nail. And that
you
just to be careful that people are discerning and saying, actually, I'm not sure I'm seeing that. Can you explain the context of why you think that this thing is this way?
Yes.
Rather than just blindly agreeing and going, yeah, it's absolutely that, right?
Yeah.
Because there is a toxic place where things can be validated that don't need to be, you know?
Yeah.
That we can't use one lens to just look at everything. We have to be zooming out, critical thinking, and applying the critical thinking. And that's something I think a lot of, in fact, this kind of cohort, these the victims of this kind of abuse, will struggle with critical thinking simply on the grounds of they've been taught not to.
They've been told they can't do it. Yeah.
And if you did it, you were punished and shamed and humiliated and mocked. Who do you think you are?
Yeah.
You think you're better than them? And so you immediately stop doing it.
And for someone who's been subjected to that for years and told that, you know, or now believes that they don't have a voice or a thought that's their own, where do they start?
The identity.
Okay.
Go straight to identity. Understand what's happened to you as much as you can, but be careful not to become... When we have trauma, we get very black and white thinking because it helps it be safe, right? So everything is a lot safer if we have good, bad, black, white, you know, all or nothing thinking. And that in turn can be quite toxic and dangerous. So first of all, really understand, but be careful that you don't get sucked into this, like everyone is toxic. Everyone's got red flags. We've got them. You've got them. I've got them. We're all going to have them. It's where you're willing to tolerate, right? You know, I get absorbed in stuff and can get snappy if I'm interrupted. It's a red flag, you know, where I can be a bit like unfairly snappy.
Yeah.
I know it about myself.
Yeah.
And I'll apologize and I'll try to be not that. But the reciprocation in that is, you know, I'm somebody who does that. So if we're in relationship, then maybe it's about working out timing, not to the point where I'm controlling you.
Yes.
But that we're just in accordance with each other. That we're supporting each other's weaknesses as well as helping each other's strengths. You know?
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
So how long would you say then the healing takes, and what does progress look like? Because again, if you're on this journey, just beginning this journey, you want to be able to sort of say to yourself, I'm making progress. But of course, you might not be in that place yet and think, oh, I'm just not getting anywhere.
Okay. The first thing I would do is, if you're listening now and this is the first time you've heard of this and you think it might have happened to you and or you're in it now, I'm going to ask you to just write a description of who you are. Write down who, what you know yourself to be, and put it in a drawer, and then start doing this kind of work of looking around at your identity and start building that up and start learning all these things, and then do the same exercise maybe 4 weeks later, and then compare it to the one in the drawer and do this regularly, right? And you'll see the progress because the description will become fuller and fuller and fuller. And I would say in terms of time, it will really depend on your engagement. If somebody is willing to put the work in and willing to be, you know, this is going to be hard, but brave and face their own toxicity, because we do. We learn toxic behaviours from narcissistic parents, even partners. Behavior gets normalized. So we think this is what parenting looks like. This is what partnering looks like. If they're not mind reading me all the time, then they obviously don't love me, because maybe your narcissistic parent put that on you. It's not reasonable to expect someone to mind read. It's not fair, right? So there's an unlearning of these beliefs that you've been taught, but it's about being able to accept that you're not perfect, actually, and that, because that in itself can be a defense mechanism of, if I made mistakes, if I didn't know the answer, if I would get punished, shamed, mocked, humiliated, so I will, even if I not got the answer, I'll try and offer an answer of any description, even though I don't know what I'm talking about, instead of just saying, I don't know, right?
Because it's self-preservation, isn't
it? And because I don't know puts you at... a disadvantage or and gives them power. It doesn't at all. It's, of course it doesn't, but it would have done in those relationships. I mean, you don't know anything, do you? Who do you think you are? You didn't even know the answer to that, so why do you think you've got an opinion? Right, so of course you then feel like you need to offer one all the time. So if you're willing to accept that you might have toxic behavior, even ones that you think are helpful, kind, loving, people-pleasing is one that is a big one. People think it's such a character attribute. It's not. It's controlling. It's almost gaslighting. And
really?
Yeah, I was thinking about it in the shower this morning, actually. That
how so?
Well, when you're people-pleasing, you're not sharing your true self. You're hiding behind your servitude to somebody. So you're not disagreeing. You're not challenging. You're not having a preference that's different. You're not calling someone out. You're overdoing things. You're telling them also, you're not allowed to reject me because rejection is too painful.
Okay.
So I do all this stuff so that you won't reject me, right? And they say to you, hey, are you upset about something? No, I'm fine, because you're not willing to have the conflict. Well, you're gaslighting them, right? Because you're saying, no, you're imagining things. I'm not angry, right? When we look at people-pleasing, on the very extreme end of that spectrum, we're talking about covert narcissism, right?
Goodness.
Oh, your face, you're like, what? Yeah. So people get, like, upset naturally. Now, I'm not saying every people-pleaser is a covert narcissist for a second. I'm just saying it's toxic. It's controlling because it doesn't allow people to reject.
Yes.
It can be very intrusive because you're rescuing constantly instead of helping. So you're doing it for them rather than
aiding them. Yeah.
And you're not allowing somebody to see the real you and therefore have informed consent over whether or not to be in a relationship with you.
Of course. Right? That's so interesting.
Yeah. It's nuts, isn't it, really?
It really blow my mind, Helen, you really have this afternoon. Can you do this without therapy? Let's say for those that are listening that are sat there thinking, I would love to go and see a therapist, but maybe I have no financial independence at the moment.
Yeah.
Can you do it without therapy?
It's going to be harder or longer, I would say, as a process. You asked how long it would take to heal.
Yes, yeah.
And I didn't actually answer you, but with my clients, I always say my goal is to have you out as quick as possible. So I think I could probably get somebody to a really good place within 2 years. And I would say I'd like to be able to do it in a year.
Mm.
Right. It depends how long the abuse has been going on, how entrenched belief systems are, how much someone's going to engage.
I was going to say how much work they want to put in as well.
There's so many variables. But there are other ways of doing it, using things like Facebook groups, using content like mine and looking at your own experience. But you have to be willing to self-reflect. You have to be able to look at what is my part. Not you deserved any of this, but how did I enable the situation to continue? I.e., did I not stand up and challenge? Did I not disagree?
Yes.
Did I not voice my opinion? Did I do all this stuff for fear of their rejection? That's okay. We're not holding you in any shame.
There's no blame.
No blame. But knowing that is the most empowering thing, because that is what will stop you doing it again.
Almost right? Accountability is then recognition.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, it's not about the shaming of, well, you deserve it because you did this thing.
Yeah.
It's you were taught to do this in relationship, to make relationships last.
Mm-hmm.
They're not healthy behaviours. And delaying someone's rejection of you only extends their rejection of you, because they are rejecting you constantly.
Yeah.
Right? So do you want to be in a relationship where you are suffering paper cuts every single day? Or do you want to be in a relationship that ends because you argued back, disagreed with something, a preference, a taste, a football team, and then you know that they're not actually the right person for you? Rejection is redirection. It is not a measure of your value or worth. Right? No one person gets to decide what you are worth. They don't have that power.
No, they don't.
Don't give it to them.
So for those that have been in or experienced, suffered narcissistic abuse, what does a healthy relationship then look like after?
Oh, that's like the $1 million question, isn't it? I think the greatest thing I could offer somebody who's had this experience is a very simple phrase. And then there's a few questions, but I'll give you the phrase first. Love isn't meant to hurt. It's not meant to be painful. If love is hurting you, it's not love, it's control. And healthy is cheering you on, holding you up, celebrating your strengths, celebrating your uniqueness, your weirdness. It's being safe to allow your childish self to be free. You don't have to protect them in front of that person. There's a James Acaster quote, have you seen, where he talks about going to Disney World with his partner? And he says, you know, and I bring the boy and she brings the girl, and it's their inner children that they take to Disney.
Oh, I see.
Right? And that, you know, what a measure of a relationship, that you can allow your inner children to play together without fear of them being wounded or hurt, which might be a bit airy-fairy for some people, and that's fine. But let's go just to love is not meant to hurt. Mm-hmm. It's not meant to cost you things. It holds you accountable. It's also quiet, just like that confidence.
Yeah.
Right? Love is quiet. It's a million little moments. It's not one big action. Mm-hmm. And if you are oscillating between pain and joy, that is not a healthy relationship. It's very stable. And actually, a lot of people find it really boring when then they get drawn back into it, because the chaos.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Because the chaos of the dopamine addiction and the that feels very comfortable and exciting.
Yeah.
And there's a familiarity. Our brains don't go for what's safe. They go for what's familiar, because that feels safe. Mm. So you have to unlearn the safety that your brain believes.
Amazing, Helen. Final question from me.
Okay.
If you could speak directly to one person mm-hmm. who is stuck in this cycle, mm-hmm. what would you want them to hear?
It's not you. Mm. It's not you. Mm. Don't believe them. You do not have to believe that you are the problem. You might have some unhealthy coping mechanisms. Those can be sorted. But you are not worth this treatment. You do not have to die to make someone love you. Right? Love should not cost your entire self. Silence and compliance. And one other thing. If they know not to do it in front of others, they know how to control it, and they know it's wrong.
Good point.
Right.
Good point.
Guarantee they don't do it in front of other people. Or they get annoyed that you've told so-and-so that they've done it.
Yeah.
And then there's just three questions that I would offer if you're struggling to know. If someone compared you to your partner and said you were just like them, would you see it as an insult or a compliment?
Very good question.
Right?
Yeah.
Are you in love with them as they are now, or the potential they have to be, who they promise you they will be?
Interesting.
And the last one is, if you have a child, or say think of a child that you know, that you love and adore, and they were to marry someone like your partner, would you be happy or sad about it?
Goodness me. Mm. That's so powerful.
Yeah. And I can't claim ownership to those questions. I saw them on a TikTok, and I forget who it was, so I can't credit them. But they are such brilliant questions to ask yourself about your partner, because if the answer to any of those questions is negative, why are you there?
Why are you there? Exactly right.
What do you gain? What are you gaining? Mm. And don't believe that they've got all the power that they say they do, because they don't. They don't. They only have what you give them, right? And that's not, again, not in the victim shaming, blaming. They make you believe that they've got it. They don't.
They don't.
Right? So, yeah.